Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What do government payouts to the food industry do for American consumers? What do they do to American consumers? Between 1990 and 2008, our food bills grew by an average of 50%, even with corporate welfare and federal food subsidies of about $1,500 per household per year. And somehow, we Americans continue to struggle with both food insecurity and obesity as healthful foods grow more costly and highly processed, low-nutrient items stay dirt cheap. Author Thomas M. Costigan investigates the reasons for this in his new book, The Big Handout, How Government Subsidies and Corporate Welfare Corrupt the World We Live In and Wreak Havoc on Our Food Bills. Thomas, welcome to Think.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking you to explain what is clearly a loaded term. What is corporate welfare as you define it?
It's basically direct payments to large corporations or agribusinesses, in this instance when we're talking about food or farm. It could be energy companies, it could be other corporations that receive government payments for a variety of reasons and very few of them good.
And all told, we're spending about $200 billion a year on these subsidies. But as you learned, tracking down exactly what we're paying for is no easy task.
Now, transparency is a very, very difficult game, and especially when you're dealing with all sorts of programs that lap into insurance programs, different payment programs. It gets very, very complicated. And there is also some provisions that Congress passed to make it even more difficult for us to track down exactly what we pay and what we get. So it's a difficult process to really find out the number. But you know, I've done as best job as I could, and others have really sought more information from the Freedom of Information Act to try and track down numbers as well.
So it sounds like you're saying it's complicated on purpose. They don't want us to know.
That's true. I mean, there's a big obfuscation coming from them because this is, in many instances, outrageous in what people actually get. I mean, we're talking about multimillionaires as individuals receiving direct payments from the government. In other words, our tax dollars go to, you know, high-profile individuals and others who don't actually even farm receive direct payments. In other instances, it's corporations that own increasingly the farm business, and they are, you know, into the millions of dollars in revenue. So we've seen a provision that just came down through Congress that said, okay, you know, no more $2 million people net worth can receive direct farm payments. But if you have $1 million, it's all right. So, I mean, it's a little bit ridiculous when we start to think about the traditional, you know, Grandma Moses farmer with the pitchfork. That's not the case anymore.
Let's go back to when it was the case, because agricultural subsidies really got underway as a response to the Great Depression. When those programs were first set up, what were their goals?
It really was to give a leg up. And if you're, even today we talk about farm income and non-farm payroll when we talk about the economy. So we do have this legacy of being in the agricultural business. For a majority of people in the country. So the majority of people in the United States way back then actually derived their income from the agricultural industry. It was a much more of a rural type of environment. That's obviously changed. So we've grown up as a nation and had our businesses move into more manufacturing technology, et cetera, et cetera. And we've moved far away from being reliant on agriculture as our main source of income. So back then, it was really to give the farm business and our place in the world a bit more of support than what we had at the time. Mm-hmm. And so that, unfortunately, has manifested into just a real boondoggle for big businesses that saw this as an opportunity to reap government payments and to produce commercial products for not only us here in the United States, but for people around the world.
Why did agricultural subsidies not recede after the economy had stabilized, particularly following the Second World War?
That's easy. One word, lobby.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, big businesses in any sector traditionally hire lobbyists in Washington to keep their interests in mind. And the same thing happened as the farming and agricultural business grew into big business. And by lobbying the you know, politicians on the different committees to keep the subsidies for a variety of threats, whether, you know, the $2 hamburger or the, you know, $15 gallon of gas is the veiled threat that might occur if subsidies go away. That obviously is not the case or hasn't been the case.
Mm-hmm.
And but the actual lobbying has stayed in force. So even though it's a great question, you know, the economic circumstances have changed, the subsidies have stayed in place. And even as far back as, you know, 1996, there were traditional farm payments that were supposed to then go away, and they didn't. They just actually stayed on the books and have, in many cases, increased. So now we have a $300 billion farm bill that is making its way on Capitol Hill in secret these days that has traditionally been a matter of public hearings and debate. Because the super committee is now taking it under its umbrella and may just rubber stamp, as far as we know, the provisions.
We were supposed to get all these reforms in the 2008 Farm Bill. What happened there?
Yeah, that didn't happen. That was a big sneak. And again, with the economy in such duress and then with food prices at an all-time high, which we've actually eclipsed this year, according to the Food and Agricultural Organization of the United Nations, we've gone past the food price index that we did in 2008 this year. So back then, it was, again, the same veiled threat, a lot of political lobbying at the same time that we had an economy that was in a downward spiral. It really escaped a lot of people's notice, to be perfectly honest, and there was a lot of political backdoor maneuvering that went on at the 11th hour that put in place many of the same programs that were in place for the previous farm bills, you know, throughout the course of, you know, probably the last 20 years.
I was interested to read that not every agricultural product or every farm qualifies for subsidies. Can you explain the parameters that govern who gets money and who does not?
It really goes by crop type as well as size in many cases. So there are, you know, the major crops are soy, wheat, cotton, rice, strangely. And those are the big ones that actually receive the most amount of money because they're historically been the ones that have had subsidies in place. And, for example, with the corn industry, that's been a historical subsidy that's gone on and then morphed into all sorts of other products that we now use in our diet, like high fructose corn syrup and other sweeteners like that, as well as, you know, biofuels, clearly, and, you know, other things that are now coming in to replace petroleum in our plastics. So we have a real different type of system that has gone in to encourage these types of crops to be grown from just a legacy basis, to be really honest.
Hmm.
And then in terms of size, the biggest agribusinesses, you know, about 70-plus percent, it's about 71, I think, at this point, percent of all the subsidy recipients are major corporate agribusinesses. So it's not the family farmer, and it does go by, you know, actual size and what you grow. And the tragedy of that is that it encourages the wrong type of not only environmental impact, because if you're just allowed to grow that one type of crop, right, if you're, say, a corn farmer, you're encouraged then to practice monoculture.
Mm-hmm.
Which is, by any account, not so great for the planet. So we've seen just an amazing amount of soil degradation occur within these types of environments and within these farms, which then require, that's why it gets so complicated, you know, more pesticides and herbicides. And then what happens with those, they are then run off into some of our streams and our groundwater sources. And so now we have, you know, a coastal systems that have become infected with this, and even groundwater sources, all from just, you know, these subsidies that encourage the wrong type of programs to be, you know, or products, I should say, to be grown to begin with. So, you know, it's really a very intertwined, interconnected system, as you can tell, that is, and that's just a part of it, that is largely operating behind, you know, closed doors and within a very small circle of not only businesses but political circles as well. So when you start to get into that type of, you know, tight group, it's tough to get in there and see what's in the tent, you know. And fortunately, some people have sucked the, you know, the proverbial camel's nose under the tent and been able to see a little bit. And that's scary enough. But now that everything's being done in, you know, in secret, in essence, because there's no public hearings on these matters today, that's even more frightening because we don't really know what we're paying and what we're getting at the end of the day. And it should be known that, you know, this is serious stuff. You know, it leads to not only environmental degradation, and it leads to, in many cases, you know, obesity, because we're encouraging, you know, very highly caloric foods to be grown en masse as opposed to other types of food groups. And Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine has a wonderful chart out on that even the First Lady, Michelle Obama, has taken up and looked at and changed around and now is in a pie chart. And, you know, if you look at the subsidies and what they encourage, they're really the inverse of the type of foods that are healthiest for us, quote unquote.
Yeah, this is the chart that you have in the book, and it's titled, Why Does a Salad Cost More Than a Big Mac?
Yeah. Yeah, so it really, I think, is very, very telling, and you can just see from that the amount of, you know, vegetables that, for example, traditional vegetables like, you know, our greens that we all were, you know, so loath to eat as kids. But then we realize, oh, there's a reason that, you know, these were being forced upon us. Those types of food groups really don't receive any subsidies at all, whereas, you know, you have other groups that are, you know, very fattening for us that do receive all sorts of subsidies. And it should be known that when people talk about even livestock or beef and those types of things, you know, feed is a big portion of the price consideration when you're producing, say, chickens or, you know, any type of pork product or obviously meat. And, you know, when you have feed accounting for about 60% of the cost of a chicken, and then you subsidize that, you know, you can see how all of a sudden you have those images from Food Inc. come flying through, no pun intended, chickens. So we have, you know, very, very interesting sneak into our food supply that subsidies have now cracked open the door for.
And yet the meat industry can say, without technically lying, well, we don't receive federal subsidies.
That's correct. Mm-hmm. They do receive, they don't receive direct payment subsidies, but they do receive other subsidies, though, for, say, you know, especially with the hog industry, for environmental cleanup, because hogs, you know, is the reason why people are called pigs in certain ways, in a pejorative way, and others, you know, take on that term because they're messy. And, you know, pigs create an awful lot of effluent, and something has to be done about that, and that is an environmental cleanup issue, and we do subsidize that for certain livestock producers. And there is certain hazardous conditions that they can apply for as well. So, I mean, you know, at the end of the day, though, you're right. They can just say, nope, we're not part of the farm program.
Author Thomas M. Costigan is my guest. His new book is called The Big Handout, How Government Subsidies and Corporate Welfare Corrupt the World We Live In and Wreak Havoc on Our Food Bills. Join us now. We have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can also email think@kera.org. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies. You can study a variety of topics such as creative writing, human rights, and the arts. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is investigative journalist Thomas M. Costigan. His new book is called The Big Handout, How Government Subsidies and Corporate Welfare Corrupt the World We Live In and Wreak Havoc on Our Food Bills. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Thomas, there might be people listening to this discussion thinking, well, it does make sense to provide guarantees for farmers so that they won't go under if they have a single bad season. How does crop insurance play into what we're paying for?
Yeah, that's part of it. We're talking about $5 billion in just direct payments, mm-hmm. straight up to the industry, and then about the same amount in insurance. And there's talk now that the direct payments that even Obama and many, you know, farmers say, you know, we don't want to take the heat, let's just get rid of them because, you know, for them, we're talking about, you know, multi-million dollar businesses. And when you divvy that out amongst all those farmers, it's not enough for them to take the scrutiny in many cases for some of them. And so they're saying, okay, let's not take the direct payments, but here's another sneak. What they're going to do is put it into the insurance side of that so that if prices do dip, for example, they will be covered. Now, when you and I probably think about prices dipping, we're saying, wow, if they go down, you know, 40, 50, 60%, then sure, we should, you know, do something about that so mm-hmm. we can still have our food supply and have security. But we're talking about a program that is a shallow type of insurance program that may protect prices. We don't know because, again, this is being negotiated in secret, as low as 5%. Off market prices. So when we talk about insurance, again, it gets very complicated. It's not a flood comes as, you know, it has in Thailand recently and just wipes out an entire, you know, crop, for example, of rice or whatever product. It could just be that prices dip because of market conditions 5 or 10%. And that's what they're talking about in this program, 5 or 10% of shallow insurance. That would then allow these farmers to protect their investments in their products.
It sounds a little like price fixing if you have insurance for a 5% dip in the raw yield.
Yeah, you said it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Jerry in Denton. Hi, Jerry.
Hi. Well, listening to this conversation, it reminds me a couple times in the past week, I've heard people quoting or paraphrasing de Tocqueville talking about the dangers to democracy if it arrives at a point where politicians realize that they can grant gifts of their people's money.
Grant, can you say that again? We have a bad line with you, Jerry. If politicians can do what?
Yeah. If politicians realize that they can give out the people's money to the very people that they're governing, that will spell a great danger to the idea of democracy.
What do you think about that, Thomas?
Well, I mean, it's politicians' job to divvy out money to the people that they're governing by definition. It's how that they do it and to whom that they actually, you know, as the caller said, gift the money that, you know, really deserves a great deal of scrutiny. So I think, you know, he's right in terms of looking at it from that particular lens. But, you know, we have to then look at how it gets divvied out. And this is my big pet peeve, you know, why isn't there not? When you go to the store and you get a receipt for what you pay, when you pay your taxes, what are you paying for? We don't know. If there, you know, to any great degree, if there was something that came with that that said 1% of what you just paid, which equates to X percent or X dollars of your taxes, just went to defense, just went to big farmers, just went to your roads, your transportation, I think that would go a long way to people going, oh, that's what I'm paying and that's what I'm getting. We don't have that. And if you look at who's actually getting in these circumstances, it's some of the biggest corporations in the world and some of the wealthiest people in the world. And, you know, we scratch away at some of these discussions when we talk about the Occupy Wall Street type of movement, or we talk about the give back of taxes by the billionaires movement. And, you know, this is what comes into play, as the caller intimated. Who are we paying? And first and foremost, what are we paying for? And I think that's what the big question is on everyone's mind these days. So I can imagine that, yeah, you've probably heard this across several different discussions, because the theme pops its head up in different ways, and it's really the same thing, and it comes down to transparency. And unfortunately, we don't have a great deal of that today. And we were supposed to, with the, you know, Obama administration coming in and saying this is, we're going to be very open about what we're doing, but we've actually seen a little bit less, unfortunately, in what we're actually paying and what we're getting. So I think that there's that first step that has to be made to really just open up the doors. After all, it is taxpayer money, and say, this is how much we actually receive. Does anybody know how much per person that, you know, the government actually takes in? These are really just very simple questions when you start to dumb it down. And then to say, okay, we paid X amount per head. What are we getting for that? Now we can start to get into the discussion about the deficit and start to get into some, you know, reductive measures. And everyone, just like a co-op, would understand, oh, all right, this is what we're all going to have to do, and that, then again, hopefully would promulgate voting. So I think once we start to get down to the basics, we have a real, real strong foundation that can be built upon. And right now, we're still, you know, working with a very, very fractured foundation.
I think when we catalog the list of natural resource advantages that we have in this country, few people would debate that we're very lucky that we can, by and large, feed ourselves. Is there any reason to believe, Thomas, that without these gigantic food subsidies, we might see large producers getting out of the business and therefore requiring us to import more food from abroad?
Well, we already import a great deal of food from abroad, and we also export a great deal of our food here.
Yeah.
So, you know, we are in a global marketplace, whether we like it or not. And we've become net importers now of, you know, fruits and vegetables. And that hasn't really disrupted our food supply or our food security. If we needed to, you know, that's been the great thing about the United States of America, is that we can subsist upon our own natural resource wealth, as you just said. We have a great deal of, you know, energy here. We have a great deal of food. If you look at, you know, the San Joaquin Valley out in California, it's an amazing, amazing display of food and where it's grown and how it's grown. And, it's the most expensive and the biggest and most complicated water system ever devised in the world. And that speaks to the irrigation that we've invested in, and that speaks to, you know, the food that we have at our disposal. So I'm not scared so much about the food security of running out. It's how much it's going to cost. Hmm. And like anything else, you know, there's enough oil in the world, but how much is the extraction, you know, cost? And it's just the same thing is coming to a head with food now. So whether we're at, you know, that kind of peak food as opposed to peak oil is yet to be, you know, determined. But we're starting, obviously, to see ways that we can reduce that cost. And we export a lot of food around the world as well, and sometimes because of these subsidies, that has some snapback when we're dumping, you know, our cotton or, you know, our soy or other types of products on the world market. That angers some countries, especially the farmers in those countries. And so that has some, you know, implications for us as well. So I think it's time that we got out of the bubble and said, look, we are in a, you know, global marketplace, increasingly so, especially with technology. And we have to be able to play in that world in a fair way. And not only subsidies here have to be addressed, but this is a big issue. How do we address subsidies around the world? Because that creates trade wars, and we're in many of them with China on an on-and-off-again basis because of subsidies here and there.
Yeah, in some cases, we produce food so cheaply here that we can export it to another place and actually sell it cheaper than local growers.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's a great story about Haiti. I don't know if you looked into mm-hmm. this at all, but, you know, and there's something called Miami rice. We grow a lot of rice here in the United States, and, you know, the U.S. does not look anything like Southeast Asia that I just came back from a few weeks ago. But yet we are, because of subsidies, we're able to grow it, and we're actually able to grow it relatively inexpensively. So in Florida, they have something called Miami rice that they were looking to export. And, you know, in the 1980s, and what happened was that Haiti was looking for certain loans from the International Monetary Fund, and the U.S. basically said, you're not going to be allowed for those unless you reduce the tariffs down to about, you know, 3%, so we can export some of our rice into your country. And we did that, and we put a lot of Haitian rice farmers out of business. This is very well documented, and President Clinton's even apologized for this. And we flooded the market with our Miami rice, put a lot of farmers deeper into poverty, and, you know, created a lot of, you know, not a lot of great feelings, a lot of ill will toward the U.S. from Haiti alone. Now we've done the same thing with cotton in, you know, different places in Africa, and we've done that in South America to a great deal as well, and to the point where we're actually now paying cotton farmers in Brazil to grow cotton because we, you know, pushed them over so much in terms of our subsidies, and were found guilty in the court, in the World Trade Court. So, you know, it really does have many different ripple effects, what we do here and what that does abroad. And that ill will sometimes turns into, you know, action, and that action is not pleasant because it comes up in the form of, you know, terrorist activity or other type of activity that lashes out against the United States. So I think we have a real opportunity to actually put the U.S. indicia on some, you know, great, not only social enterprises, but food products and other things that come out of this country to show who we really are as a people and to build upon that, whether it's in the Middle East or whether it's in South Africa or other developing nations and in South America, and other developing nations around the world to be able to say, look, this is what we can actually do for you. Build that model city in, you know, Iraq and show people what it can be like. You know, produce that type of food that is actually healthy and relatively inexpensive and abundant and show that what that can be like for people. And I think there's an opportunity here as opposed to looking at it as such a grave situation.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Rhonda in Murphy. Hi, Rhonda.
Yes, hi. My question is there a way to accurately name names in terms of people, and particularly our lawmakers, who are voting either for or against these farm subsidies? Is there an accurate way to pull the curtain back to find out if they have a vested interest in either continuing these farm subsidies to go on because their investors, their family farms are getting it, their backers are getting it? Because so often we get the information, but I have no idea how to act because I don't know who to act for or against.
What can you say to Rhonda, Thomas?
Fantastic. I mean, she's dead on. That's exactly the question that needs to be asked. And people like the Environmental Working Group, so if you go to EWG.org, just to plug that nonprofit, they've done a tremendous amount of work in this space, and they've created a database that actually does name names and shows who actually receives what as best that they can. Because they admit they've run into a lot of roadblocks because there's been a lot of, you know, just shell games that have been created, as well as roadblocks in Congress for them to actually get the information. But that does name names, and it does name, you know, politicians who have even received subsidies, and that's been the case, and who receives what in terms of lobbying dollars. That's more of a question for something like Open Secrets. If you go to opensecrets.org, same type of thing. It shows how much lobbying dollars are waged to different politicians. So, you know, there are many outlets online, and then with that information, there are many other things to do. I get into a whole list of them in a chapter in the book, and, you know, we can run over that as well. But that's a good start.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Next on the line, we have Johnny in Comanche County. Hi, Johnny.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
Okay. Just a couple of comments. One, I'm in the beef cattle business, and fat cattle out of feedlots are bringing record prices, but we're losing money because of the high price of corn. And I'm going to blame that on the ethanol-type substance. What do you have to say about that? And did he say something earlier about hog flatulence?
Well, I think he was talking about hog waste that has to be dealt with. But let's get an answer, Thomas.
No, that was just some, you know, either wishful or creative thinking on the readers on the caller's part about the hogs. But there's a great question about the food versus fuel, mm-hmm. and that is something that's playing out in a big, big way all around the world. And I'm so glad he asked that, because there's, you know, incentives to either, you know, produce fuel, biofuel, and ethanol, which, as we all know, is a bad, bad choice, because it, you know, takes more energy to actually get the stuff out of the ground and turn it into energy than we get net-net as the energy that we can utilize, versus the food that we actually could get in that same space. So that has increased prices a great deal. It's part of, you know, the complexity of this issue. When we're subsidizing ethanol more than we are actual food groups. And that has obviously a big dent on, you know, supply. And you go back to the very basic demand versus supply. If we're incentivizing fuel rather than food to be grown, then we have less supply, which drives up the prices of food. So that is another issue that's playing out within the, you know, this whole farm bill as well, because it includes subsidies like that.
Need to jump in and take a quick break here. Thomas M. Costigan is my guest. His new book is called The Big Handout, How Government Subsidies and Corporate Welfare Corrupt the World We Live In and Wreak Havoc on Our Food Bills. If you'd like to join us, the number is 1-800-933-5372. Email address is think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is author Thomas M. Costigan. His new book is called The Big Handout, How Government Subsidies and Corporate Welfare Corrupt the World We Live In and Wreak Havoc on Our Food Bills. If you'd like to join the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Thomas, recently here in Texas, we had a scare with some cantaloupe that came in from Colorado, I believe, and it was contaminated and a lot of people got sick. Are we at least getting, for these huge subsidies we're paying out, are we getting safer food?
I say not. And I say not because we're encouraging, by the subsidies that are doled out, corporate farming, which is also another word for factory farming. So the biggest corporations, the biggest corporate farms receive the most amount of subsidies. That's a fact. And these factory farms, in turn, turn out mass quantities of food. So by doing that, they obviously have, you know, greater quantities of those foods that they're actually producing, which means that, say, if it's, you know, a livestock producer, there's a lot more heads of that livestock. And the, you know, chances that some type of disease could spread through livestock greatly increases. Same thing with any type of other type of food product. And the standards are, you know, something that right now, food inspection is just not up to speed by a lot of accounts. You know, we have a great, you know, ways to go in terms of food inspection. So by encouraging, in my mind, you know, mass quantities, it's very difficult. You know, if you go through immigration or if you go through an airport, you know, security check, you understand this concept, and there's a lot more people. There's probably a lot more likelihood that you're not going to get checked as well rather than an individual that walks through. So by, you know, encouraging the mass producers then and products, then there's more opportunity for things to slip through the cracks in terms of inspections and otherwise, and a greater propensity for that type of disease to spread more quickly when things, whether they're, you know, vegetables or, you know, live animals are in tighter quarters, then it's much easier for that disease to spread more rapidly. And as I said, you know, the chance for that to be actually identified is slightly less in some circumstances and greatly less in other circumstances. So I don't think we're actually getting, you know, again, what we're paying for.
So we have concerns about foodborne illnesses. Perhaps even greater these days are diet-related illnesses. The First Lady has taken on childhood obesity as her personal cause. Why haven't we shifted subsidies away from producers of high-fructose corn syrup and toward people who are growing asparagus and peaches and things that are good for us?
Sure, because if you walk down the food aisle and you go into, say, the you know, the farmer's market section, you're going to see all, you know, very, you know, pretty vegetables displayed out there in a basket here of cucumbers and another box of tomatoes, and then you're going to have some nice, you know, spray over your asparagus and your broccoli. And then you walk down to kind of the mass quantities of stuff in boxes and that's frozen and that's put in all sorts of different displays. You walk down that aisle, and if you take a close peek, you'll see a lot of things peering out at you, and those things peering out at you are lobbyists. Because the mass amounts of food actually pay for those lobbyists. And when you're creating something that produces, you know, money as opposed to producing something that is healthy, they're not exactly the same type of thing because it costs a lot more. The margins are far, far less when you produce anything that's, you know, quote-unquote organic, or something that is, you know, slightly more custom or more attentive. Made. And that's just the fact of it. So the money goes into the actual production and growth of that particular item as opposed to putting the money into sales, marketing, and lobbying. And when that occurs, you're getting mass quantities of food that are particularly not that good for you and lead to some of the things you just talked about in terms of health consequences. You know, the biggest consumer of beef in this country is not, you know, you or me or anybody else sitting at a fine steak restaurant and chowing down on a sirloin. It goes to the fast food restaurants that actually churn out, you know, burgers or whatever concoction they can make it in different names that have cute marketing, you know, types of messages to the masses. So that's where it goes, and that's where the game is played on a very profitable kind of field. And I think for the rest of it, there's just not enough dollars that go into producing, you know, anything on a family farm that could compete with any of the major agribusinesses today. So that then bleeds into other types of areas, and, you know, we suffer from a health standpoint.
Let's go back to the phones now, 1-800-933-5372. We have Melanie on the line in Dallas. Hey, Melanie.
Hi, Chris. How are you doing?
Very well, thank you.
I have a comment and a piece of advice. I guess two comments. The first is just going back to the conversation that your guest had with one caller who wanted to know how we could perhaps learn more about what's going on in the negotiations around the current farm bill with the super committee and how we can get more light brought to bear. I think people in Dallas are in a unique position to actually get pressure Congress in that regard because Jeb Hensarling, who is a congressman, Republican congressman that represents parts of Dallas and I think a big chunk of Garland, is actually the Republican co-chair of the super committee in the House. And anyone who's in his district or near his district or who has supported him or not supported him lately can certainly reach out to him and express concern directly. And given that there are only a dozen members on that super committee, that gives folks in your listening audience a real opportunity to have influence that others might not have. Having said that, and being a deep believer that I think all of that should be open to the public and that there's a lot of things that have gone down in a lot of previous farm bills that weren't beneficial to everyone, I'd really like to say that I think your guest drawing an awful lot of conclusions and condemning an awful lot of industries without any facts to support it. And I'm a little dismayed by that, Chris, because usually you have a more objective approach to speakers, and at a minimum, when they express strong opinions, which I certainly enjoy, whether I agree with them or not, you look for facts to support it, and I so far haven't heard anything except opinions offered by your guest, and I find that a little disappointing. I don't even know what his credentials are.
So, well, let's get a response, Melanie. I appreciate your call. Thank you very much. Do you want to answer that?
Yeah, I think, you know, three words will sum it up. Read the book, and in the book, you'll find all sorts of facts and figures to back up anything that I've said here. If I were to drone on like those people at the end of the car commercials with the fine print, I don't think we'd have much of to talk about today. And, you know, if the, I guess the onus is being laid on me, I would suggest that your reader, your caller who had a great comment to begin with, which is to, you know, pressure your local congressperson for information and to voice your opinion, would use that same type of energy and do that there. That's who's creating these laws, and that's who's divvying out the money, and that's who is responsible for this, reporting upon what's going on, and not obviously creating the subsidy system myself. So my job is to really create enlightenment. I celebrate the fact that opinions are being expressed, and that's what this is supposed to be about. And hopefully people will then, either get angry, dismayed, or otherwise, and take issue with the subsidy programs that are in place today and do exactly what your caller just suggested, which is to reach out to their local congressperson and ask what's going on, ask what can be done, ask what is being, held accountable on their behalf. And that is, I think, what is going to change the system. So I really, encourage that ethos, and I encourage that type of visceral response. But, putting it on me as having an opinion, that's what I do for a living.
We'll go back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. This time we speak with Michael in Fort Worth. Hi, Michael.
Hi. I had a quick question. I know this is a little bit off of the topic, but I was essentially concerned with the free trade agreements that are being proposed right at the moment. I was raised in southern New Mexico, and when NAFTA was enacted, I watched all the industry that was on this side of the border move directly to the other side of the border after NAFTA was enacted. So my question, I guess, is do you feel that these free trade agreements that they're trying to get across are a good thing for the United States? And if they are, how? How is it actually going to benefit the people here in the United States?
What do you think, Thomas?
Sure. In some instances, there is going to be that type of ding to businesses here that aren't able to compete on a global basis or with, say, Mexico. But on other instances, let's take sugar. And then businesses may actually prosper. There's been a great deal of discussion, and especially right now, a couple of representatives, one out of Pennsylvania, is putting forth a sugar act to get rid of the sugar protectionism. We pay almost twice the amount of sugar for sugar than anybody else on the planet because of protectionist policies and tariffs. Now, if we bring those down, we'll have lower prices for us to actually pay at the checkout counter. but we'll also be then opening up, you know, different markets back and forth, whether it's Mexico, that we can actually then look to for, you know, different types of products for our own use, as we talked about, you know, food security before, and then lowering the price for us all. And then the same thing, if you look at different products, whether it's in South Korea, opening up their markets to our beef, which they've traditionally not done before, which gives us an advantage. So net-net, you know, while specific instances and situations may take a financial hit, overall, I think the number is a net plus of about $60 to $70 billion that will actually be created by lowering subsidies or eliminating them here in the United States. And at the same time, that money not only will flow into the United States economy, but it will create jobs. So, you know, we have a great, you know, proposition for increasing job growth, lowering the prices, and being globally competitive. And we can sit there and, you know, close our borders all we want and think we're doing okay while the rest of the world goes by. And I don't think we're in a position to do that anymore.
What can we learn, Thomas, from studying countries, developed countries, that have ended or significantly reduced food subsidies in the past few years?
Yeah, Australia and New Zealand are two great examples of that. And while they did take agricultural industries did take an initial hit to begin with, they've actually profited much more since. And here's why. They got rid of the players that actually weren't being so financially astute. In other words, businesses that were just bad businesses and they weren't being run properly but were surviving on the government's dole and on taxpayers' handouts. And what happened was those businesses, of course, squawked, complained, and then eventually, you know, sputtered and died. And then when they went away, the other businesses became much more efficient with their products and the way they produced things. So it created efficiencies, it created different scales of economies, and it actually allowed the industries to thrive rather than just kind of, you know, sluggishly go along. So we've seen a couple of really good examples come out of that over the past few years here. And I think as we start to see the developing nations, in Africa or South America, Central America, which great, you know, natural resource wealth, take up a lot of the same issues now, I think there's an opportunity for them to start to think about some of these programs in the same way that we're thinking about them today, which is, you know, let's not have government support these types of programs for a long period of time because they become dangerous and, you know, they're really not healthy in a number of different ways.
The new book by author Thomas M. Costigan is called The Big Handout, How Government Subsidies and Corporate Welfare Corrupt the World We Live In and Wreak Havoc on Our Food Bills. Thomas, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Today's show was engineered by Justin Martin. Christine McConnell produces the podcast, and our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. You can email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.